What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of This Is Hot Boga. We're going to take a time to just kind of thank some of our sponsors that helped make this happen.
Next up is Hill People Gear. We're going to be rocking their new Decker Packs. Carries weight well. It was designed and created in the backcountry, not in some design studio. If you're looking for rugged, dependable backcountry gear, check out hillpeoplegear.com.
So another company we'd like to thank is Steerka Optics. They've been a longtime sponsor of the show, and we're very thankful for them. They continue to have elite products out there in the industry, and if you're looking for a new set of binos or a spotting scope, you need to check these guys out. Our RK1s from Newbury Archery really made it easier for me and James to be adaptable to the traditional world. These custom bolts were made exactly for us and how we wanted them. I got mine dipped in ASAT, and it's absolutely beautiful. Check it out.
Because they do custom dipping and stuff too. Bowworks and Kyle and all those guys do a great job with that.
Newbreedarchery.com.
We care about the world that we live in and the world that we hunt in. So we love companies that really work hard to preserve the land that we hunt. One of these companies is United by Blue. One of their initiatives is that they will clean up a pound of trash out of your waterways for every purchase that you make there. And it gets even better. You can enter promo code HOTBOGA in, save yourself 10%, buy some fantastic gear for hiking, for everyday wear, and you can do good for the environment. Go to unitedbyblue.com, buy yourself some dandy threads.
So Northern Broadheads just sent us some of their brand new barefoot shafts, and I can't tell you how sweet they are. I just had them bare shafted at Long Range Archery here in Holland, Michigan, and I'm shooting straighter than I ever have. If you want to get some of these shafts, head over to their website, save yourself some money, use the promo code HOTBOGA and save yourself 10%.
Anyways, Chad, give me a little bit about a background, how you got into hunting, where you live and what you do now.
So just a little bit about myself, I guess. I got into hunting really from my family tradition. It was always, you know, growing up, it was always tradition to not necessarily go to gun camp for a week, but, you know, the first day of firearm season, everyone would take the first couple of days off. And as a youth, that's something we always looked forward to, because at the age of 12, 13, 14, like, that was our kind of acceptance or graduation into manhood. Like, you got to go out with men, spend a few days in the woods and kind of be mentored, you know, by my grandfather, my dad, my uncle. So that is really the very, very first memories I can kind of collect, like going back to the whitetail woods.
Where was that camp?
That was in Ohio on a family farm. So I was lucky enough to grow up with approximately 500 acres in our family. Beautiful whitetail habitat. Just almost a pristine whitetail. I mean, you couldn't imagine a better piece of whitetail habitat. Rolling hardwoods, some regen with some clear cut and timber management that had been taking place. Probably somewhere between 180 to 200 acres of row crops. So very, very, very diverse. That's very perfect. Very good age structure. And for the most part, outside of that, you know, week window, there wasn't a whole lot of pressure on the whitetails. I mean, everyone gun hunted growing up, but it wasn't, there was no one really serious, no one really into archery. So it was, outside of that week, it was really unpressured, which played into my cards later on as I kind of graduated into archery and taking on, really getting obsessed with whitetails, chasing mature whitetails at least. So that's kind of how I got into hunting. As I said, I'm from Ohio, still reside in that same area, Northeast Ohio. And right now I am co-owner, co-founder, and operator of Exodus Outdoor Gear, which is essentially Exodus trail cameras.
So you guys, so I would imagine this isn't your first, I mean, starting the company wasn't the first time you used trail cameras. Why did you guys decide to start a company when there's, you know, there's a couple of them out there already that are pretty good?
There's a ton of trail camera companies in the marketplace, and it's a super, super competitive niche. But for us, being obsessed with chasing mature whitetails at a fairly young age, we started using cameras back in the 35 millimeter days, like pre-digital, in the late 90s. And, you know, over the course of 14, 15 years, I had almost used every single camera known to man. And a lot of, you're right, there are a lot of good cameras out there. Specific models from specific manufacturers and different years are better than the next. But we essentially just got tired of buying cameras, having them fail, you know, 12 to 18, 24 months after purchase, and then dealing with the lack of customer or product support on the back end. We had went through the process, you know, over those 14 or 15 years, we would buy different brands and we would, you know, have that experience. So we would try a different brand and have a similar experience. And we just felt like there had to be a way to make a better product and then be able to service that product on the back end at a higher level than what was being offered.
Yeah. I mean, there's no greater, I don't know. I think it's tied between two pain points when it comes to trail cameras that I've experienced in the past. It's putting it out, getting a good spot, coming back 2 weeks later to find that you didn't turn it on. I've done that before. Have you done that, Jared?
I've done that before.
Yeah. I mean, it's, and you feel, so that's painful because you feel like an idiot. The other painful one is you get out there and the battery's working.
Mm-hmm.
You see fresh tracks and the camera has malfunctioned somehow.
Right.
And I last year I had that, I actually stopped running a trail camera because the one that I had been using, the couple have just,
They crapped out after a while.
So that is painful. And then you try to call those companies and if they're some of the larger end types of companies, you don't necessarily get a, you know, I would assume if I call, I'm getting one of you guys. Exodus, and you don't necessarily get that kind of customer service. So I could see how that's a huge benefit to you guys.
And a lot of that revolves, you know, starting at the R&D phase or process of designing and specifying the hardware of these cameras, and then going into the back end support. All that revolves around being consumer direct and not servicing, you know, the large retailers and really just focusing on the end consumer.
Well, that's interesting because a lot of the guests we've had on that are parts of companies, whether it be First Light or New Breed, a lot of them are going, we just talked
Ozonics.
To Ozonics direct to consumer. Mm-hmm. Why did you guys do that?
Well, it allows us to spend a little more money on the hardware end. So actually spending more money on the product to increase the longevity or the lifespan of the product. And then being able to offer it at a competitive price because there's no retail markup built into the MSRP.
Yeah.
So when you start looking at, you know, the retail structure of goods, when you're going into a box store to buy products, there are several people that have their hands and are all taking a little piece of the pie before the end consumer gets it. So for us, we didn't want to just be another camera company to build a $200 product and have everyone's hand taking money from that and then leaving the consumer with, you know, basically the same product that's offered everywhere else.
Right. Well, and your margins are lower then too, right?
Yes, absolutely. Everything that we do, you know, we try to stick right around that 50%. So there's, you know, if we're selling $200 product, there's, you know, there's $100 into that product on our end.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good stuff. And I, you know, we've actually liked the move just because a lot of our favorite gear is now a lot cheaper. And generally, the quality is better. I know QU kind of started it off maybe 10 years ago now. And I think it's smart.
Yeah, Jason and, you know, the QU brand, regardless if you like the way they've done it, you know, some people aren't in love with their brand, but, you know, they have really been the company that's built the foundation or paved the road for consumer direct companies. Now you see companies like us, companies like Maven Optics, First Light. I mean, there's so many companies coming into the marketplace utilizing e-commerce and really offering a better product to the end consumer. So it's exciting to see the movement inside the industry.
Yeah, we like it too.
How did you figure out how to put a camera together when you're making your prototype to begin with? Tell me about that process.
Yeah, absolutely. So my background is not actually in consumer electronics. It is in civil engineering. And I had a short stint after college working with a civil engineering and construction group and then transitioning into telecom, working for an A&E department, working with, you know, large carrier Sprint, AT&T, and Verizon on a little more technical level. But with the camera side of things, it really spawned from looking at individual pieces of hardware and buying, you know, what we call breadboards or testing boards and buying components from like DigiKey and different e-commerce sites and playing with PIR sensors and processors and microcontrollers. And not necessarily building homebrew cameras, but it was more to repair, you know, existing cameras that we had, and then kind of taking that a step further and saying, okay, well, all these individual pieces of hardware, some of them they're made of different grades. So there's consumer electronic or consumer grade components, which have a 2-year lifespan. There's industrial grade stuff. There's medical grade stuff. There's automotive grade stuff. And there's a different cost associated with all of it.
Right.
But all of it has a, you know, each grade has a different life expectancy. So that's where we spend just a little more money and we're able to, you know, increase the longevity of that. But to actually bring a product to market, you know, typically what we do is we'll write a specification sheet and spell out specific pieces of hardware that have to be used on that specific product. And then that is then outsourced to an engineering team, which would come up with a PCB board design and then the software on the back end.
So a lot of work goes into these cameras.
Yeah. Well, it is a lot of work. You know, for a standard camera, standard SD card camera, it typically takes us, we've done three of them now, that's anywhere from 9 to 12 months from the start to bring that product to market. Mm-hmm. On the cellular end, you know, we've just gone through that process with Verizon, launching a Verizon certified device.
Yeah.
That is a little more in depth, and the timetable almost doubles there.
Okay. And now you work with Verizon. Does that mean you also work with carriers like Cricket? Because that's the carrier I think Jared uses. Because
my service sucks, man.
He basically,
you brought that
I'm calling
up.
Him. I'm, you know what? I always
piggyback off the Wi-Fi in my house to make a phone call. It's just a dead
time. Is it Cricket? Or is it, what's the one? The Cricket is the one you know, the Jitterbug. You got Jitterbug?
No, I have Sprint.
I don't believe it. So you guys work with Verizon.
Yeah. So the camera we just launched, the Render, is a Verizon certified device. So that I'm not familiar with Cricket or Jitterbug or whatever you guys are talking about.
Jared, but wireless.
I know, like working with being in telecom prior to this, I know that some of those smaller regional carriers will actually lease bandwidth or channels from more of the major carriers like AT&T and Verizon or Sprint or whatever. So I'm not sure exactly what band those are running off of, but the device we just launched with Verizon is a band 13 and band 4 device that runs off the LTE network. So if a product were to use or a carrier were to use, you know, band 13 or band 4, then yes, that product would work. Now that's the same case when you go into Canada, where Verizon's not prevalent, but they're still using band 13 and band 4 through, I think, Bell Wireless, I think is the carrier. So it's all, it just depends on the band.
Yeah. I mean, you guys are just essentially encouraging people to be on their phones more, the way I see it, you know, those things.
If
I know that pictures are coming in the middle of the night, cause that seems to be usually when I get the best pictures or the biggest deer. Uh-huh. I mean, I'm going to be up all night waiting for that picture to come in.
Just have a TV monitor.
That's right. Hooked up to the TV and just have it pop up.
It's funny. We've been, we had our first working prototypes of this camera last January, last February, you know, and getting those things fired up and working with the mobile application. When we first started using them, everyone was super excited. Like you're getting push notifications, you're getting the right. pictures and videos into your phone. And then after like 4 months, when you have, you know, 12 or 15 of those things going off at the same time, it's like, you just want to turn the damn thing off.
Overload.
Now, how do you guys manage pictures? How do you, is that something you guys do or you offer, or what's your way of managing? Because Jared and I were actually just talking about this. I don't remember who, maybe Huntwise, about how you manage your trail camera photos.
Yeah.
And right now they're in like multiple folders, incorrectly labeled on my computer.
Yours might be.
I use
all my photos up on the cloud.
Well, yeah,
I sort them all through that way.
Do you sort them by like location and time and everything else?
Usually just month and year.
So yeah. I do kind of all of the above for standard SD card cameras. So I have, we're very, very big on annual data and creating logs on specific deer with year over year over year information, because I think there's a lot of value there. Typically what I personally do is I will go in and create a folder on my desktop for a specific deer. Now inside of that main folder, I will break it down by year. And then each folder, you know, whether it's 2016, 2017, 2018, then I will then break it down by location. So there's several layers there for me to really stay organized. Now, it seems like a lot of work. I'm not doing that for every buck I have on camera. Anything that's typically 3 years old, a three-year-old or older, that's what I'm doing with. And really trying to at least have 2 years of data on that deer to use in that third year, you know, when I think I'm going to go after him.
But before we move on, I wanted to take a minute to thank one of our show sponsors, Pelican Coolers. These coolers are extremely tough and backed by a lifetime warranty. But what I like most about our coolers is that as tough as they can be opened with the push of a button. So it'll keep the bears out, but you won't have any trouble getting in. And it gets even better. Right now, if you type in pelicancoolers.com/hotboga, you'll get a free tumbler with the purchase of any cooler. And we all use the 32-ounce tumbler, and it does an amazing job at keeping hot drinks hot for a very long time and cold drinks cold for a very long time. I'm going to do something maybe a bit unusual or something that I haven't done yet, but I'm going to throw out a James D. guarantee, which is something I don't just toss around willy-nilly. I'm going to James D. guarantee that if you buy one of these coolers, you'll have the best cooler experience you've ever had, and you'll be changed as a person for the better. Your life will be totally different from here on out. So don't take my word for it. Go check them out for yourself, pelicancoolers.com/hotboga. And now, back to our show. I'm assuming these deer all have names that you've given them.
Ooh. You know, I do name deer, but I'm terrible at it. I'm not, I don't get romantic about the idea.
Now you have to share one.
Yeah. What's your hit list, deer? What's his name?
Deer I was chasing last year. I think his name was Billy the Kid. He was just a big giant 6-pointer. I had 3 years of history with him. You know, nothing super special, but it always, you know, just being a mainframe six, it just reminded me of like a six gun, like a revolver. Yeah. Yep. Yeah, exactly. So it immediately took me back to the Wild Wild West days.
I can get on board with that one. Yep. That's a pretty good one.
I'm tracking.
Yeah.
I'm tracking. Well, I want to get into some of your trail cam placement strategies, but one thing that, you know, we hear a lot is that people, and usually it's an older generation, kind of bemoan the fact that technology is so heavily relied on all these days. So mapping software, you don't know how to do land nav now, or trail camera. Well, now you don't know and understand how to read natural deer sign and language, body language and everything else. Do you hear that kind of thing a lot when you're, talking with people at these trade shows about trail cameras?
No, not as much as what you think, because a lot of the things or points that we preach on, or I shouldn't say preach, but talk about with using just standard SD card cameras is using them in conjunction with boots on the ground scouting.
Right.
Because regardless of when you're pulling those SD cards and checking your pictures and gathering that data, it's dated. And as we all know, in the whitetail woods, so many things can change in a matter of 3 to 7 days.
Yeah. The acorns drop and suddenly their pattern totally changes. Mid-October, everything's different. Mm-hmm. They're hiding.
Exactly. So that's why we always go back to that annual historical data and trying to match, you know, those dates year over year over year to use it in, you know, the following year. So boots on the ground scouting, there is no substitute for being able to cut tracks, read sign, you know, look at habitat structure and, you know, understand the way deer move. And really when you go through and look at all the guys who are killing deer with purpose. So they're going out and hunting deer and doing it on a consistent basis. Those guys aren't relying solely on trail cameras. Yes, they're using them, but those guys are able to go out, read sign, be able to make moves in the deer woods and, you know, ultimately put themselves on deer.
Yeah. That's critical. It's all parts of it. Why not use something that would help, but you still have to be out there and learn and be able to adjust because, you know, what maybe was working early season first, maybe week is totally different than you get second, third week, October, where you have the lull and we won't even dive into whether the lull is really a thing or what the lull actually is. Cause that's maybe 5 more podcasts worth of content. That's actually leads me on to my next question. So, are you running trail cameras right now? When do you start rolling trail cameras, or maybe that's something you do all year?
Yeah, we have cameras out all year. I don't get very, very serious about collecting whitetail information really till late July, early August, where you know, those deer really came into their own and you know what they're going to be. And for us through the Midwest, it's, you know, for the annual data side of things, I personally don't pay as much attention to it until hunting season comes in because I can't hunt deer on their summer bed to food pattern.
Right.
Typically that is going to change when they get hardhorn. Food sources are going to change around that same, you know, October 1st.
Yeah, of course.
And a lot of that data becomes a little bit irrelevant. Now, as there's a possibility there where you could see some type of pattern where those deer will come back to their summer areas, maybe during the rut to focus in on their bedding locations.
Around. Yep.
Exactly. But yeah, so I mean, like I said, we run trail cameras all year, but typically we don't get very, very, you know, super technical and serious until those deer have kind of taken their shape in late July, early August.
Yeah. How many trail cameras are you running then?
Over 100.
Well, that's a lot of notifications.
That's like maximum security prison status.
Yeah, I have 20 to 30 cameras on a piece of public that I have not checked since 2017.
You're just leaving them out there to, and they're sending pictures to your phone.
Those are regular SD card cameras, so they've been soaking with lithium batteries for over a season, season and a half.
How do you do that? Like how does it not eat you to wonder, ate at you, wondering what could be on? It could be a monster buck that's been sitting around your stand for 2 years.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. It crosses my mind every week. I need to get down there and get those things pulled. Logistically, it's 6 or 7 hour drive from where I live. So that's part of it. But, at the moment, I don't have any intention of going back and hunting that public until 2020. So I won't be down there in like 2019. So my plan for those specific cameras is go down. I think I'm actually going to go down and pull them during turkey season, gather that data, and then go back probably late September and put them back up to gather the 2019 data to use in 2020.
So you're taking a bit of a scientific approach here. Mm. What is special about why 2020? What has led to that decision?
That specific area was hit with EHD in 2017. So I'm just allowing that area to recover a little bit and just let that age structure grow. So there's a more, I guess, target rich environment.
Yeah. You getting any of your trail cameras stolen out there on public land?
Yeah. One or two will get stolen every year. That's unfortunately, that's kind of the nature of the beast. Last year I lost 2018. I lost six on it was a piece of walk-in. So it was a private piece that had walk-in access that changed hands, was sold. And yeah, that was a bummer. I lost six there. And then I think the year before that I lost four. So it does happen, but I don't think it's as prevalent as what some people think, at least not in my area.
Yeah. I don't know. Have you ever had one?
I've never had anything stolen. No.
Remember that one time in
Dallas? Yeah. I had just bought that thing.
I know, you were bummed. That was like a college pine tree. Not like we had a lot of cash to throw around then. And some guys stole his stand. Yeah. So, and this is a debate Jared and I have a lot. So a lot of times we're out in the woods and you see a trail camera unlocked, and obviously we're not going to steal it, but there is the debate. If you have a card reader, what is your take on, protocol or maybe common courtesy? Are you allowed to check another man's trail camera or do you have to let that sit and wonder? What would be your approach to that?
I personally have never checked another man's trail camera, but I would think that if you were to check it and not tamper with the settings or, alter the setup in any manner.
Right. Just viewing the pictures.
I don't think there's no way. Yeah. Just viewing the pictures. I don't think that there's any way anyone would find out. I guess that would be like a personal ethics call on.
I was going to say, because if you're talking ethically, if the ethical reason is because no one will find out, is
all I'm saying.
Because Jared and I have this debate. Go ahead, Jared.
I'm saying is I've done it.
You've done it?
I've done it.
You're going to get some hate mail.
That's fine. I went up north into a place I hadn't really been to before. I had a couple days to go there.
Yeah.
I saw a trail camera. I had a card reader in my back just because I wanted to see what was out there.
Yeah.
Popped it in. Didn't mess with the guy's settings.
Yeah. You just were a silent observer.
Checked out the pictures.
Very passive. But you're just the difficulty I have is
that stealing?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know that it's stealing, but it's almost, it's not an invasion. Maybe it's an invasion of privacy. What I kind of see it as is you're piggybacking off another man's hard work. You're just showing up. You're a freeloader. No,
I would tend to agree with that as far as like the freeloading thing, because I get a lot of messages about different, that specific piece of public that I'm hunting, and they're like, hey, I know you hunt this area, can you point me in the right direction? It's like, man, I spend 30 days a year down there, probably 70 miles, I probably walk 70 miles a year. It's like, I dedicate a lot of time to trying to be successful down there. They're like, go put the work in, go do it yourself, So I can appreciate that statement a lot.
Yeah, but devil's
advocate.
I do too.
And it's not like I felt great about it afterwards. You do feel a little bad about it.
The guy, though, also should have been a little bit smarter about where he put his trail camera. I mean, he should be thanking you for not stealing it. I mean, you could have been some bad guy.
I did him a favor.
You did. Was there any bucks on the trail camera?
No. There wasn't one picture. No. There was a picture of a squirrel, so I guess I learned my lesson.
Yes. And Jared, you know, walked by in the nude and gave him a little surprise.
That's funny.
I did not.
No. All right, before we move on, we'd like to take a minute to do our first installment of First Steps with First Light. During this series, different folks from First Light will be breaking down different aspects of hunting for the new archery hunter. So this week, we've got Greg Farrell, Product Operations Manager from First Light, on to discuss a few beginner tips for the whitetail hunter. Greg, what is some advice you have for the beginner whitetail hunter out there?
I think from my perspective, when comparing whitetail hunting to a lot of other styles, specifically Western, it's different because the goal of whitetail hunting is to put yourself close to deer. So the animals are coming to you versus you going to them. The first one I would say is to really just learn about deer, honestly. And probably the best way to do that if you're new to whitetail hunting is to find, I would say, a resource. We live in a pretty awesome time where there's so many resources between podcasts, YouTube videos, etc., where you can gain a lot of knowledge in a pretty short amount of time. I would say the second one would probably be spending some time observing the ground that you plan to hunt on. If you can do that, say, maybe from a road, pull over, get your binoculars out, watch field edges, where are deer coming in, where are they going out. If you have a availability to get on that ground in the winter, you know, it's a very low risk, high reward activity to go walk around because you can see, you can follow trails in the snow, you can see where deer bed. And if you bump them, it's really not that big of a deal because it's a long time before your upcoming hunting season. The third step or third tip I would have to kind of bring all that together is just get out there and hang some stands, and don't be afraid to mess up. As you hang those stands and you either, you know, have success seeing deer or don't have success seeing deer, maybe you're seeing them but they're not close enough, or maybe they're too close, you're gonna learn a lot about your specific area that you're hunting, you know, deer movement, where you need to be, what you need to do, X, Y, and Z. So I think if you can take those three steps, you know, over the course of a season, you're gonna come out with a whole lot more knowledge and a whole lot more experience to set yourself up for even more success in the future seasons.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Greg. And for everybody listening in, make sure to tune in next week to hear another segment with First Light. So say it's early season, you're prepping for lull, however you want to define the October lull. Are you moving trail cameras at all, or are you keeping them where, you know, you think the early season will be, and then maybe you'll adjust midway through the season? How are you doing that?
I am, with running that many cameras, I'll have cameras in travel corridors or pinch points that I will leave up all year. Like in the hills and I guess hill country and big woods, saddles, benches, fingers, a lot of those cameras are staying in place, you know, 24/7. But for specific early season strategy, I'm focusing on early season food sources. If there's, you know, again, going back to boots on the ground scouting, typically late summer, I'm going to be walking the woods with my binoculars, trying to find white oaks that are going to be dropping acorns, or maybe soft mast trees, apple trees, pear trees, whatever, and be placing cameras in areas that have that early season food source. And then also in historical areas of located around bedding that will have scrapes. They'll have bed scrapes. So those are the two early season things that I'm doing kind of prior to, I guess, we'll call it October 21st, the third week of October. Yep. Yeah.
So you say you find a spot, the ideal, you know, picturesque spot.
And you deploy your 100 trail cams.
Yeah. No, I'm talking about one. You know, you found a good spot for this one trail camera. Mm-hmm. How do you determine how to place it, where to place it, which way do you point it? You know, give us a little background about how you actually place a physical unit in the woods.
Yeah. So I'm not worried about, for me, I'm using these as a tool to kill big deer. So I'm not worried about necessarily the photo quality per se. Now, I know that some people are worried about image quality, and you've probably all heard the phrase, you know, face your cameras north so you can kind of control the light a little bit. And that is true. The more you're able to control the light coming to the camera, the better your pictures are going to be. That's kind of photography 101, you know, controlling the light. But for me, I like to have my cameras approximately 25 to 30 feet away from kind of the target area. So if that's a trail, I'm about 25 feet off that trail, and I'm placing my camera quartering into the trail or quartering away from the trail.
Right.
If I have to, I'll set it perpendicularly, but I will never place it on a trail shooting down or up the trail. And there's a technical reason for that. PIR sensors, the way that people think they work from motion and heat, and that's true, but that's the easiest way to explain it.
Okay.
There's actually two elements inside that sensor, and both those elements are weighted equally, and they see through a Fresnel lens that diffuses that into a more intricate detection area. And those two elements are actually picking up the infrared radiation of the environment. And then when there's a change from one element to the next, that is actually what's triggering the camera. So when you have that camera aiming straight towards something with head-on movement, both of those elements are going to have the same reading, and the camera really struggles to pick anything up that's in that detection area.
Okay. Interesting.
So I always like to, again, I always like to place my cameras approximately 25 feet away, either quartering to, quartering away, or perpendicular to that target area. And for me, I run it on the fastest trigger delay or the shortest trigger delay I can run. And a lot of times I'm running video mode. I like to have video mode. So I'll throw in a large card, lithium batteries, and then let that thing soak.
Yeah, let it sit. And now, this is maybe a personal question for Jared.
Oh, my.
You know, you mentioned that you're pretty good at waiting, pick up your trail camera, and I'm the worst at it. And
so you are the worst.
Jared's always having to tell me, no, you set it up yesterday, you can't go check it, that kind of thing. Now, what would be your advice to Jared when I'm saying, hey, Jared, let's go check our trail cameras, and he wants to say no, but he needs a new way and a better way to tell me no? What would you say to me?
I would say, dude, you're just going to screw yourself, man. You got to wait.
Yeah, I've said that.
He doesn't listen. No means no. Yeah, maybe that's it. Maybe I just got to think of the benefit.
God, you're making us sound like an old couple right now.
You know, that's as far as hunting goes, I feel like we're kind of like an old hunting couple.
Old hunting couple?
Yeah.
I could take that.
Well, I won't say anything else.
Two kindred spirits.
Yeah. Yeah. No, he keeps me in check because I do. I tend to check him just because it's just exciting. Anything could have walked past, you know?
It is. That's the cool thing about running cameras all year. Like this time of year, you know, you can almost go in and check. As long as those cameras, you know, aren't embedding and you're worried about bumping a deer into a neighbor's property and shedding somewhere else, like, you can go check those cameras whenever you want, especially during turkey season. It's awesome.
Oh, yeah. You go out. And the deer don't. Right now, I mean, we literally were just in my backwoods shooting before this podcast, and we had two deer just run right past us, not even concerned. So, yeah,
isn't this is crazy how that happens.
I feel like she knows. I don't know where they keep their deer calendar or what, but it's like, you know, right up to the season, I see him all the time. And then, you know, I have a couple acres that I'll hunt every once in a while with my daughter, and like season comes and they're just gone. I don't know where they go.
Yep, that's crazy.
So clearly my mistake is always checking too early. Another mistake maybe is pointing it up straight up trail, which I've actually done before because I thought I was being really smart, giving it a lot of extra time to soak in movement. But, you know, like you said, it's not made to pick it up then. What's the other like most common mistake you see when people are setting up their trail cameras?
Not with cameras that don't have viewers, it's very easy to have that camera, you know, kind of angled down or angled up, and depending on the terrain, that, you know, you may need to do that if you're on a hill or a slope. But not having them in a, I guess, parallel line with the slope or the grade of ground that you're on can really affect how that camera's picking up motion. If it's just angled up just 1 or 2 degrees, then that PIR sensor, all of a sudden when you're out 25, 35, 40 feet, you're, you know, 8 or 9 feet off the ground,
right,
which is obviously way over the back of an animal. And vice versa, and just the opposite. If it's angled down 1 or 2 degrees, then you're cutting your detection area, you know, way, way, way too short. So that's definitely a common thing that we see when people are setting the actual cameras up. And then programming the cameras, you know, you'd be surprised that these things have been around for so long, but there's still a lot of people that don't know, you know, what the time-lapse function is, or they don't know what the trigger delay is. And to their defense, every manufacturer may have different terms, or, you know, every camera is set up a little bit different. So if you're running a kind of a scattered fleet of different makes and models, it can be difficult at times to remember, you know, the specifics of each camera. But just knowing those basic, I guess, terms can be a big help sometimes.
Yeah, that's super helpful. I've had trouble with settings, not that much. My biggest setting trouble is just not turning it on. I've done that.
Kind of a concerning.
And that's really concerning the trouble. Most basic one.
That's a big one. Yeah,
that's how you get the pictures.
You know how your car, when you leave the lights on, it just beeps really loud? You know,
yeah.
I'm going to give you guys this free suggestion for your trail cameras. Mm. Maybe make a beeper so when you set it, it just beeps unless you turn it on. You
that's can, funny.
It's free for you guys from Hot Boga.
Yep. You're welcome.
So actually, there's actually, it's not an audio alarm, but there's a visual alarm. So when you turn our cameras on into the on mode, after 30 seconds, they'll time out and there's a red and blue LED indicator that will flash. And once those flash, that's telling you, hey, the camera's armed. You're good to go. Walk away. If you don't see those lights, then there's a problem.
Okay. Yep, that is helpful. Just a little help.
A Jimmy indicator.
A little, yeah, the Jimmer. Yeah. The Jimmer. Yeah.
The Jimmicator.
So
that was dumb.
Yeah, it wasn't great. You know what? We'll edit that out.
I tried.
Can we beep it out so it sounds like you're tough and sore?
I don't care.
So you're, that's obviously, those are super important. You've told us about managing your trail cameras. What are some ways that you work to prevent people from stealing your trail cameras? Because, you know, I've seen locks and things that even protect them from bears and stuff. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, I mean, I still feel like a really motivated thief would figure out a way to get through those, you know, like steal proof things.
Yeah, that's a big topic. You know, one that's probably one of the most searched search terms on the internet about trail cameras. Like you said, there are locking devices, Python cables, band mechanisms, security or bear boxes. But for me, I don't like using those devices because, one, I don't want to have to worry about carrying a set of keys.
Yeah, I know.
For 100 cameras that if I leave the key, you know, if I pick the wrong key or lose the wrong, don't have the key on me, then I can't, you know, I can't pull the camera or can't check the camera or whatnot. And then I don't want to have to carry around a 3-pound steel box,
right,
you know, with me when I'm setting these things up. So what I'm doing in areas that I think that there could be potential for that camera to grow legs and walk away, I'm just carrying a stick, a climbing stick in with me. And I'm typically putting those cameras, you know, 8 to 12 feet off the ground and, you know, just using some kind of mounting device, or if I'm using a strap, I'll just place a stick behind it and get that camera angled down a little bit. I put it anywhere from 8 to 12 feet.
Okay. Wow. Okay.
8 to 12 feet. I just carry one, like a 32 inch stick, just a climbing, you know, a climbing stick, like an XOP or a lone wolf stick with me. And then I just get those. I'm 6 foot tall, so I stay on top and put that on. So, yeah, anywhere from 8 to 12 feet, depending on the tree. And then if I'm putting a camera lower to the ground, I'm looking not to put it on obvious pole shaped trees. If there's a tree that has a split in it, or on a cedar tree where there's a little more horizontal cover, then I tend to gravitate towards those spots. And any way that I can hide a strap. So a lot of times I'm picking branches up off the ground and whatnot and jamming them down in around that strap and breaking branches to cover that strap. A lot of times people are walking through the woods and you'll see a strap. You'll see the strap a lot of times before you see the camera. So
because it's a horizontal, like straight line.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a horizontal. Yeah. You have a horizontal shape on a vertical tree. It's very easy to spot. So any of those little things you could do, if you're not, you know, elevating your cameras and getting them out of the line of sight of people, any of those little things will definitely help.
Yeah. I've seen Jared get pretty creative.
Somebody needs to make a 3D trail camera strap.
Like something like a leafy camo.
Leafy. Yes.
Yeah.
Make something looks like bark that just wraps around there.
Yeah, I like that. There's another Boga tip for you.
Number two.
That's a solid idea.
It's a solid idea.
Again,
you know, our L&D department has been working on that for
a prototype.
That's right. We'll get a prototype working and we'll mail it to you.
Yeah.
So you have had trail cameras stolen. Have you ever caught anybody picking them up?
I have not. No.
No.
I've never caught anyone picking one up or stealing them. I know that we've had customers call in and had had theft issues, and a lot of times we'll send them like an empty shell or a dummy camera, and then they'll set that down low and then put an active camera up higher and kind of aim it down and try to catch the individual. But I've never personally never had the opportunity to do that.
What would be your approach to a situation like that?
What's with all these stealing questions?
I don't know, man. I
are you very concerned about stolen cameras?
That's like, seriously, most of the time when I'm talking to somebody about a trail camera on public land, they're big concern. Their number one thing that they talk about is theft. Yep. I don't know if you're hearing that too, but that's always what I've heard. So I just assumed.
Hey, carry on.
So say you catch somebody in the act. How are you going to approach that situation delicately?
if I caught them in the act, or if I was planning to catch them in the act.
Obviously, you know, it seems like you've got a solid plan with the dummy cam and everything for trying to catch them. But say you catch a guy, you figure out who it is, or maybe you're even out there and you see him. What are you going to do?
Oh, I don't think there's any delicate approach, man.
Yeah, no.
You say, hey, heifer.
I think that's going to be pretty confrontational. Yeah, you know, I'm going to approach them, ask them what they're doing, why they have their hands on my property.
Get your hands off my rig, bro.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think that that'd be too delicate of a conversation.
No, I you know, it's funny. And the disclaimer should be that 90% of the people you see in the woods are not the thieves or mean or aggressive. Like most of the time, most of my experiences with people in the woods has been really positive, where they've gone above and beyond just to help, because we're all part of, you know, hunting brotherhood, if you will, and sisterhood for the female audience listening. Yeah, for the ladies. But yeah, I mean, things can get pretty tense in the woods. And so sometimes I think about, like, how would you handle that? Because a lot of times there are firearms involved. Both parties during deer season, gun season. So you got to be with this diplomacy that's really required for that.
Yeah. Well, just a kind of an interesting internal stat that we have. The vast majority of thefts that we get calls on are actually cameras on private land where there's been a trespassing event, or you know, someone is on a piece of property that they know they do not have permission to be on, and then their picture is taken by that said camera. So they're either taking the SD card or they're taking the entire camera to prevent, you know, legal action of that manner.
Yeah, that's those are some. Did you ever expect to be dealing with those types of situations and things like that when you entered the trail cam world?
Well, we did. We did somewhat, yes, because of the warranty policies and the, you know, with everything we do on the back end with the 50% off stuff. So yeah, that definitely was on our minds. And you know, for us, that's, you know, to your point about, you know, the woods being filled with good people, you know. A lot of what we do on that side, I mean, yes, we do track it with serial numbers and product registration and whatnot, but we rely heavily on the honor system for a large portion of that. And people are so grateful and just pleasantly happy with what we're trying to accomplish and how we're trying to service them with that policy. Mm-hmm. There's not a whole lot of people out there cheating the system. So,
well, what is the warranty specifically
on the theft and damage side? So we offer a 5-year manufacturing warranty. So if anything goes wrong with that camera on the manufacturing end, we actually will physically repair it, or we will replace the unit inside of 5 years. Now, in the event of theft, or we call it accidental damage, like if the camera gets, you know, flooded by, you know, you hang a camera in the Mississippi and it's underwater for, you know, eight months, or a bear chews on it, or lightning strikes it, or whatever. Somebody steals it. We'll replace that camera for 50% off, you know, one time inside of that 5 years. So it's just a way for us to, you know, we're not losing any money. We don't make any money, but we drive depth inside of our customer base because we don't see it as a sales opportunity. We see it as an opportunity to prove the business model and the customer support, you know, to show people we're serious on that end.
Oh, and there's a level of trust that you get with a company you're buying things from, if they're willing to stand behind what they do that much.
Care for their consumers.
Yep.
Right. Absolutely.
Well, Chad, I appreciate you taking the time. I mean, the trail cameras you guys make are awesome, and the tips that you gave us were really helpful. So
yeah, we really appreciate
the time.
Awesome. I appreciate the invite and the opportunity to talk to you guys. And wish you guys luck in all your ventures, and feel free to reach out if you have any questions, trail camera specific.
Absolutely. Yeah,
perfect.
Thank you.
Thanks, man.